Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, May 25th, 2017. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
There's a lot of stutter stepping there, guys. I'm sorry. We've been sitting here trying to get the levels right. Levels so that you will hear this in the way that you wanted to hear it. Now Abe's coughing and the whole thing, it's very unprofessional. It's amateur hour. That's if you read my piece in Commentary Magazine June issue on podcasting and the unlikely success that we've had with podcasting in general. I think podcasting has been having altogether because it is kind of amateurish, and I for one am not a big fan of the amateur outside of the High School Musical production kind of amateurism. But, you know, if you think that it sounds authentic, that's great. We aim to be extremely authentic, and our authenticity requires that you go to iTunes and leave a positive review, because that's just the thing that a person ought to do so that our rankings gets lifted and more people subscribe and our influence spreads far and wide and America becomes a better place. Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, cultural analysis, and political wisdom, shall we say, from a conservative perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.95 gets you a digital subscription. $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly mail magazine in your mailbox. My God, I cannot speak the English language today. The June issue with that short article by me on podcasting also includes major pieces by our own Abe Greenwald sitting across from me. The cover story, Is This the End of the Free World, that we discussed on the last show, and Noah Rothman sitting closer to me, who has a piece on how to be conservative in the age of Trump. So go look, go read. Sign up, subscribe, go to iTunes, leave an interview, send me your firstborn child, and everything will be fine. Guys, so we haven't really discussed the horrific, nightmarish bombing in Manchester. And, you know, as somebody with, you know, sort of tween daughters, the idea of a you know, violent attack on the teeny bopper Ariana Grande, you know, the concert, you know, full of girls exactly like my daughters, of course, kept me up at night, as it did so many people. And we find ourselves now in a situation in which there seems to be a new terrorist style that has been innovated here, where you find the perimeter at the end of the event, not the beginning. You don't have to go through any security, and you can just wait until the crowd comes out and then detonate your device to horrific effect. That, of course, is not really the big story. The big story is the geopolitical story of whether Britain responded adequately in the months and years prior to the event to do the things necessary to have prevented it in the first place. And that's when we get to first causes. Like, we know there were clearly police failures and security failures, because the bomber and his family had been reported several times to the Manchester police and I think to the British intelligence services as people who were expressing frightening opinions. And we had travel to and from Libya. We had training in Libya, all of that. And yet they were sort of let free to do whatever it was that they wanted to do. Obviously, the suicide bomber's brother was arrested in Libya. His father was arrested. So where does this leave us when we look at what this means for them and what this means for us, Abe?
Well, you know, also that's kind of a story we hear again and again. That's the way it's sort of gone down here as well, numerous times, where authorities have some sense of these people, then they sort of lose track of them, or they don't think they're quite that much of a threat, and then it turns out they were. One of the things that struck me about this attack was I went back to thinking about what Barack Obama had said. It might have been in his last State of the Union, where he said that ISIS, or these terrorists, I think he said, pose no threat to our way of life. The only threat to our way of life is if we, in our fear, destroy our own way of life. And I thought he was wrong then, and I think he's wrong now. And I think this sort of demonstrates how our way of life can be chipped away at, because so Ariana Grande has now canceled the rest of her tour, right?
Not clear, but she may be. It's still up in the air.
And I really don't think that going to concerts is, I don't think it's going to be the same. I mean, I think there's going to be some sort of protocol going forward, or if not immediately in time, just the way that travel has changed, and we do so few things sort of together, you know, in the West anymore. Anyway, to have that sort of change on us, and to have there be some new sort of security protocol, or maybe just sort of fewer concerts altogether, or something. These things do actually change the way we live.
See, that sort of introspection seems premature to me, maybe a little misplaced. I mean, on the other side of that, you've seen your Katy Perry's who say we have to open our borders now, and you've seen your Morrissey's who are saying we have to close our borders now. It's all very much about us and what we can do. This was a return to status quo anti-terrorism. This was a plot with links to Libya, with links to Germany. The device was extremely sophisticated, very expensive. It utilized possibly two detonation methods, where it could be detonated remotely as well as by the individual who was a suicide bomber. As Max Boot talked about on a post and commentary, this kind of suicide bombing approach is something that Israel has dealt with. You can't secure every location, and suicide bombers did begin to target, for example, the lines outside of security areas. And how you deal with that is you dismantle the organizations around them, because one suicide bomber, this isn't the kind of low-tech terrorism that we've become accustomed to, where somebody's radicalized online or in a mosque and then hops in a truck and kills as many people as possible. This was an attack with foreign links. And that's the sort of thing that we should be focused on, is dismantling the organization that exists abroad.
Right. We don't know why the British lost track or didn't take this seriously. I mean, it's not clear. Manchester itself is a very liberal city. Its mayor said all kinds of, kind of silly, bland, sentimental things about how he didn't like tougher security protocols and how they were all about fear and stuff like that in the year before this happened. And so clearly the question is, was this just the kind of failure where you just can't make sure that you are – it's a belt and suspenders approach where you put on the belt and you put on the suspenders, but then it turns out that you also need three other things in order to make sure that, that the pants stay up. And if you don't do the three other things, but you've done the belt and suspenders, it turns out that there are a few cases in which you just can't make sure. Have they really not taken this as seriously as they should? There hasn't been the attack hasn't been a severe attack there in a while. They've had some lone wolf cases. As Noah said, this is the opposite of a lone wolf case. It appears to be a sort of family plot with specific on-the-ground training about how to make a sophisticated bomb that would do the ultimate, to do the most amount of damage. I mean, you can't figure out how to make this kind of nail bomb online, fortunately. You need to sort of have bomb maker training. And the sophistication to know where to place yourself outside a security perimeter, and when, and how to wait, and all of that. Those are matters of paramilitary terrorist training. My feeling is that Abe may be more right than you're acknowledging, Noah. If you sort of think in general, we have the Bataclan attack in Paris, which is an indoor arena, right, where there was this horrendous bombing, and now we have this stadium bombing, and you sort of look around, you think about just the where we live and around where we live here in the New York City area, you know, you have Madison Square Garden, an indoor arena. You have Yankee Stadium. You have Citi Field, where the Yankees and the Mets play, and where they have concerts when they're not playing. Or Citi Field certainly has concerts. You have the Meadowlands. You have all sorts of places where the perimeter rules that that we saw, you know, in play here, you know, could take out thousands of people if you play your cards right. In Madison Square Garden, for example, you know, people are sort of funneled, end up in a funnel where they, you know, have to go through security and they're waiting online for security in these long lines. But like, you could come up right up while people are waiting, you know, to have their bags searched,
right,
and detonate your bag. Like, you don't have to go inside. You could do it there.
Well, if that was the idea, was just to kill people, then they would have targeted a transit hub. You know, the idea was to kill kids.
Right, to kill kids and to make a point about, you know, I don't know, pop music and stuff like that. You know, one of the things that some of us said in the wake of 9/11 was you had these spectacular attacks, right? You had these, you know, major American icons being targeted, the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, presumably the White House or the Capitol for Flight 93. But that there was some fundamental misunderstanding of what would truly unnerve Americans and make them change their lives, which is, wouldn't you try to bomb the Mall of America or five high schools, you know, at the same time on the same day, places where it's much easier to sort of to stage something horrific, but again, logistically complicated because you would have to sort of time them and do all that. But, you know, if you really made people unnerved about whether their kids could go to their school or, you know, whether they could go to the mall, you know, in the wake of a major terrorist attack, you really could have had American life shrink the way life around Washington, D.C. shrank in the period of those 2 months when there were those snipers shooting people at gas stations and things like that. And then, you know, people were like staying home, weren't going out. Like, they, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people stayed inside, like the summer of 77 when Son of Sam was on his killing spree in New York City. And you had this, like, you had this definite decline in the number of people out and about, because even though the numbers of people killed were small, the sense that, you know, the randomness was what unnerved everybody. So, I don't know. I mean,
yeah. But also, I just want to say, I mean, I agree with Noah's point completely. I'm the one thinking about how this may sort of shrink our public life, or our social engagement. That doesn't preclude us from going out there and tearing down
these extroversion is like sort of a, I don't know. I mean, as much as it's also a prescription for this sort of thing, it's sort of cathartic and allows us to, I mean, it's not just, it does create the conditions on the ground in places where they're training terrorists like this, where they recall their fighters and it becomes harder to execute these kind of attacks. But it also makes us feel better about going outside. Because we're not just talking about ourselves and getting paranoid.
Yeah. Now, in the more geostrategic sense, we have issues that have been raised about leaks that, apparently a leak from within the U.S. government was responsible for the release of the suicide bomber's name. You can see why, even though they did manage to arrest his father and his brother, you can see why that was so unnerving to the British, because they understood that they were tracking a network, and once the name comes out, whatever else remains of the network could go to ground, you know, unless they can get names out of people in the network, or people can flee, go somewhere else, you know, get out of the country. They still have the Schengen rules. If you're a British citizen, you can, you know, they haven't pulled out of the European Union yet, so they could just get on a train and go to Europe and not have their passports checked. And I think the larger point, which is very complicated, has to do with the immigration status of the suicide bomber. Because of course he didn't have an immigration status. You have a lot of people saying, "Oh, you see, this just proves Trump was right, and we need to have the you know, we need to have a total ban, or, you know, a Muslim ban, or ban from six countries. How banning somebody from six countries, one of which is not the United Kingdom, would have sufficed to make sure that we were secure from homegrown plots in among, you know, Muslims in who are citizens of Britain. That's an interesting question, since of course it wouldn't. But I mean, more to the point, some people were saying, you see, Trump was right, but Suicide Bomber was born in Britain. I mean, he was not, you know, maybe his father's a Libyan, so 25 years ago, his father should have been prevented entry, perhaps. I mean, one doesn't know what the circumstances were that led to all of this. But you take a single case and you then extrapolate it to, you know, an immigration policy that covers an entire country, an entire place. That said, you know, there is this weird fact about the United States compared to the homegrown populations in Britain and France and elsewhere in Europe, which is we have had these attacks by American citizens, the San Bernardino bomber, the Pulse, the Orlando bomber. But the comparison is that, you know, we really do have a sense that when people come to the United States and they make a life here and they have children here and all this, they join in the civic life of the United States. And it seems far less clear that this is true of Muslim immigrants to Britain, France, and other places, which are much more homogeneous and where being the other is much more a redolent thing. You know, you know, the whole question of, can you really be French if you're not, if you don't have, your great 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 grandparents weren't French.
Right. And this is further complicated in England, as we were talking about it yesterday, by the reality of class still being there. So that sort of further compartmentalizes communities and sort of hide burgeoning threats and also make people not care about particular areas and whatnot.
That, by the way, that the sense that American Muslims are more assimilated than their European counterparts is borne out by data. The Pew Research Center performs quadrennial surveys of the Muslim American population and has found them to be among the more uniquely assimilated groups because of they are middle class. They read English for the most part. Many of them report incomes over $100,000. They reject violence. They have more friends that are non-Muslim than do their European counterparts. So it's not just an idea, a sense, a kind of wish. There's data to support that.
Well, data supported because the simple fact of the matter is, in the United States, despite everybody's line about how there's no mobility now and it's all income inequality and everything like that, the truth is, you come here, you work hard with your hands, you get yourself a food truck, you get yourself a cleaning job, and then you get two cleaning jobs, and then you hire your friends to help set up a cleaning service or something like that. The classic route to, you know, middle class or upper middle class success for people who come here and don't necessarily have an easy way station into the welfare culture is very clear, and you have populations from the Middle East and from South Asia and all of that who are representatives of what the supposedly lost and disappearing American dream represent.
It's also, by the way, a small population. There
right.
aren't many Muslim Americans, and there are very few foreign-born Muslim Americans, naturalized citizens.
Yeah, it's about 1.5% of the population of the United States, and the Muslim population, I think, in the United Kingdom is now approaching 10%, something like that. So you have a much different circumstance in which a country that doesn't particularly look to assimilate, because that is not the cultural message. It's not sort of the dynamic institutional message of the country from the get-go, you know, basically has these populations that layer themselves more like stratifications than mix in. And it's a, you know, it's a much different thing. And I guess I don't want to downplay the idea, seriously intended and serious that the United States is changing and has been changing over time and does not, you know, is more like that in the sense that, you know, we have become so multicultural that the notion of political integration, assimilation, all of that is less attractive as a cultural bellwether to people because, you know, they think America's evil and noxious and that our founding was a, you know, was a bastion of white privilege and everything is terrible and we tell ourselves lies and myths about the Constitution, which was just a way of empowering slaveholders and white men and all of that, and that a world like this, you know, we don't seek to integrate people from elsewhere as much as we used to. But I don't see that much evidence of that. I mean, the problem that Americans seem to have with immigration, in fact, is that Mexican immigrants or mostly, you know, Spanish-speaking immigrants come here and do not assimilate. I don't think you really have to ask yourself whether if they came, you know, learned English, were unaccented, you know, sort of participated fully in the cultural life of the United States as it is defined in sort of a majoritarian sense, whether all of this hostility to them would remain as, you know, would be as thick as it is in many of the precincts. And
well, there's data to support that Hispanic immigrants, and particularly Mexican immigrants, are assimilating too, albeit at a slightly slower pace. In 2007, the late Samuel Huntington presupposed that the influx of Latin American immigrants to the United States would fundamentally change American culture, and that was tested by a variety of social scientists, and their peer-reviewed studies suggest that American Hispanics are assimilating, and the second generation in particular are much more assimilated than their first generation parents. But there is a different culture today than there was in the immigration waves of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, and that's one that sort of rewards ghettoization. It sort of creates the incentives for there to be
for some
bifurcation of Spanish language media, for example,
right, but
and
for
the ability
some,
to steep yourself in that.
I mean, I've often wondered that if, let's say, you take a small population, not the sort of, you know, Latino population of the United States, and then the illegal population of, you know, 10, 11 million, but you take a much smaller population, like the South Asian population, Indians, Pakistanis, Sri Lankans, like that. They came to this country, you know, they've made wild successes of themselves. I think there are about 1 million of them and all told, or 1.5 million or something like that. And they spread out across the United States. They went to the South. They, you know, Indians bought up motels across the South and Southwest. One of the things about them was they did, do they have a group? Do they have a Maldef? Do they have a La Raza? Do they have a political interest group in the country that is demanding special rights for them? Or did they come here, put their heads down, get jobs, get work, you know, try to make a success of themselves and not politicize themselves? By the way, they're overwhelmingly Democratic, like 60 to 70% Democratic, even though they're small businessmen to a large degree, because they do not feel, as far as we can tell, that, you know, the Republican Party is friendly to foreigners, as opposed to, say, a prior generation like them, which was the Greek exodus into the United States after the takeover of the country by the military in the late 40s, and then particularly in the 70s, the Greeks were Republican. Like, it was weird. Michael Dukakis, you know, the only Greek candidate for president. It was interesting because he was actually a deep minority among his own people in being a Democrat. But I've often wondered, so the, you know, imagine a Hispanic Latino world that didn't have an entire class of new class NGO types demanding, you know, sort of equal rights, equal victimhood rights in the country, you know, along with African Americans, who, of course, deserve to be treated in a slightly different way. I mean, this was a wildly victimized population. Even 150 years after the end of slavery, they're still dealing with the consequences of the familial issues that were raised by that and other things. And of course, Arab Americans have a couple of groups. But that special pleading hasn't helped them very much, because it's mostly become a kind of pleading on the basis of whitewashing terrorism, among other things. So I don't know. I mean, I just think that we have a different reality in the United States, which is that if you come here and you work hard, people aren't, and you work hard and you want to be an American, people in general don't hate you. But if you come here the way the migrant illegal population of Mexicans comes here and, you work really hard, but you evince no particular interest in becoming American, or you don't make no efforts to become an American, and particularly when it now feels like you're not that welcome, then Americans are going to look at you and say, well, what are you doing here? What contribution are you making to the national project, to our, even though they don't know that's what they think? This is an unconscious thing.
Right. I mean, one of the problems with sort of offering all these services to everyone, but to immigrants also, is that you change the inducement to prospective immigrants to your country. And at one point they want to come here to work hard and build on that, and then if we change what we offer, that they will want to come for different reasons. They will want to come to absorb the welfare state, which is what happens in Europe.
Right, exactly. So that's the so to move from the most serious to the more ridiculous but kind of chilling nonetheless, we have this story that broke last night about the special election in Montana, which was being watched closely because of the question of whether it would represent a bellwether if the Democratic candidate were to win their seat vacated by Ryan Zinke, I don't actually know how you pronounce it, the Secretary of the Interior. If the Democrat won there in a state that it's the whole state votes for the seat, a state that Trump won by 23, that would be a sign of a gigantic sea change. And all the evidence suggested that the Democrat was way closer than he had any right to be. And then this thing happened last night where Ben Jacobs, the Baltimore-born reporter for the Guardian, went up to the Republican candidate, John Forte, and asked him a question about the American Health Care Act. And within about 15 seconds, an irritated John Forte, realizing who he was and that he worked for a paper that that had published a very damaging piece to him about how he had secret holdings in Russian companies, grabbed Ben Jacobs by the throat, threw him to the floor, screamed at him, broke his glasses, and basically assaulted him. I mean, the tape, eyewitnesses leave no question about it. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think part of the problem with being a social media addict like me is that you get caught up in the immense drama of something as it's unfolding, and it kind of gets you all wrought up. And the question is, is this an important moment? He will likely win, I think it's thought, today. What does it mean that this guy who was arrested for misdemeanor assault late last night, what will that mean? That he will be elected with this cloud over his head? Three papers in Montana withdrew their endorsement. People are saying that people are correctly saying that this represents a problem for the growing orthodoxy for early voting, because people of 70%.
Well, that's why he's likely to win.
Right.
You have to, suggest that.
Yeah, so something like 70% of the state has already voted.
Right.
And so,
so this isn't, even if this changes everybody's mind, the likelihood is you might have 20% of the vote on same day. election day.
Right. And so this is why a lot of us have objected to this, you know, idea that it's okay for people to vote over 3 weeks, that in fact, you know, elections are contests, things happen, they go from one date to election day, and people who decide 2 weeks early who they're going to vote for are operating on the basis of incomplete and likely and possibly incorrect information. And once they do it, they can't change their minds. So there's a broader question about early voting that I thought we'd lost, those of us who think that there should be one election day, which is viewed in psychotically as an interest in voter suppression, whereas in fact it's about civic responsibility and having people have a common experience in electing people and making sure that people have all the information they need to vote. If you just simply presume that everyone lines up in partisan terms no matter what happens, you are ceding to the current political reality a dynamic that we should not wish to cede to, that people aren't capable of making independent decisions apart from their partisan interests.
This is why I don't understand very much about the argument on the other side of that, because it's intellectually consistent for Republicans usually Republicans and conservatives, not liberals, who favor same-day voting and say that it is your civic responsibility to vote on the day that you're supposed to vote, and whether or not that affects the outcome of this race. Whereas you are guaranteed, if this guy wins, to see liberals say, well, you know, mail-in voting is the problem now because their guy lost. Right. Not because of the matter at hand, not because of the issue, but because of the candidate who they didn't like, who won.
Well, good. So let them.
No, it's not good.
I'm saying good in an ironic sense. So let them deal with the consequences.
Well, because the fluidity of that logic means that they're going to come right around to the other opinion the second that somebody has a contrary opinion and says that it's, you know, it's racist and you're a racist for saying that.
So I don't know. Is it a big story nationally? Ultimately, if he wins, if he loses, it's a big story. But that's, you know.
Well, look, you know, the elephant in the room is this question of whether or not the reason that it would be a big story is the question of what it will say about the norms of American practical American politics in the age of Trump, and whether his behavior,
and particularly on the right.
Well, here's what happens: if he loses, Republicans will say, "Well, it was a flawed candidate." And there's no bigger lesson you can derive here, because this guy was terrible and he was destined to lose. Right.
Although his rival is a terrible candidate.
Right. They've refused to let him speak, I think.
Yeah, his rival is a terrible candidate who has a horrible history of tax problems and sexual peccadilloes and stuff like that. He's just a terrible candidate. So that would also be an interesting thing if he won. See, if he wins despite all that,
it almost makes you think that the stock of political talent has soured in recent years.
Well, I mean, this guy John Forte, the Republican who's winning, is a rich guy from New Jersey who moved to Montana and basically has been, you know, is described as a philanthropist. So, you know, I don't know if that means the stock of candidate is bad or whether it's just yet another case of somebody being recruited to office because he can pay his own way and, you know, and like wants to be a congressman so that because he already has his yacht and he already has his plane, so now he could, you know, buy a political seat for a while. You know, that's one of the destructive things that's happened in politics over the last 30 years, the sort of recruitment of rich people solely because they're rich people. Sometimes consultants do it because consultants know if you can hook a rich person, maybe he'll spend 40 or 50 million of his own money in a futile effort to get elected, and you'll get 15% of that over the course of the election. But
committees love it too. Committees love self-funders.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so there's that. And of course it's actually a relatively cheap place to run for office because it's, you know, it's one district, one state, a couple of television stations, you know. You do a lot of driving, but you go on radio. And
there's also something refreshing and healthy about not having a government that's entirely populated by people who have wanted to be in government since they were 18 and sort of, you know, worked every step of the way toward that.
Well, that's true. So you have these two different kinds of populations, right? You have the people, you know, who you remember being so annoying in student government, and they go on to college, and then they're in student government in college, and they go off to law school so they can win the, you know, place on the law review. And then, you know, it's just basically like this hunger, which you can say in a positive way is a hunger for public service, and a negative way you can say is just them, you know, jockeying for power because they want to be in a position to tell other people what to do.
Right,
like,
and right.
Hall
and
by the, monitors, you know,
the
hall monitor
approach.
And by
the time they get anywhere, you know, impressive, they've already compromised themselves and, you know, God knows how many ways.
10,000 different ways, right. Well, so there is that, the X-factor businessman, and that's what...
Right.
So John Forte, in that sense, represents a kind of Trumpian model because he's not a politician. He comes at politics late. That said, if you listen to the tape of him attacking Ben Jacobs, the guy is a psychopath. I mean, I say that advisedly. Like, if you listen, you can hear, you could. There is a split second at which he puts together that Jacobs worked for a paper that published a bad story about him, and then he lunges for him, and it would be as though right now I looked at Noah, and before I finished saying the next word, I went for his throat. I mean, and then you heard a tussle, a scream, and the fall of floor, and, you know, like it would, like that. It's horrifying to listen to. It is like seeing somebody lose control of himself in a millisecond. You know, it's exactly the sort of person you don't want in politics.
Right.
That is not what you want, but you want somebody who is, you know, calm, reasoned, you know, can slow down and make a decision and, you know, not do everything, you know, from the gut.
And there's also nothing righteous about his anger. It's not, you know, it's yeah. there's no cause
yeah,
to
yeah, because
champion.
He, yeah, because Jacobs wasn't obnoxious. He asked him a question about the American Health Care Act, which we should now start,
I don't think we fully exhausted this subject because there's a lot of ensuing fallout that has been almost more disturbing than the event itself, although the event itself is extremely disturbing. John, I think you wanted to discuss how the campaign responded to this.
Right. So 10 minutes after Ben Jacobs tweeted, I was just body slammed by John Forte and he broke my glasses, and Alexis Levinson of BuzzFeed said, "Oh my God, I just saw Ben Jacobs thrown to the ground. I don't know what I just saw." Shane Scanlon, the spokesman for the John Forte campaign, issued a statement in which he said, Ben Jacobs sort of obnoxiously approached John Forte. He was told to leave. He put up his recorder in a threatening manner. He was told to put it down, and he didn't. And then the accusation is, he aggressed first. There was a scuffle, and he ended up on the ground.
And also, he's works for a liberal outlet, so
right.
Solidarity. Right.
So two things here: this guy, I don't know who he is. I don't care who he is. I hope he never works in politics again. It's disgusting. It's disgusting to, you know. It's like people just now lie in public when people didn't lie that much in public. It's a whole sea change, you know. And I blame Bill Clinton. I seriously blame Bill Clinton for going up there and saying, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky, and I never asked anyone to lie, not a single time, on January 25th, 1998. That was a hinge moment in American history because the President of the United States looked into the camera and lied about something that he had done and then had to confess that he had done it 8 months later in a deposition. And, you know, people moved heaven and earth not to lie. In American public life. Like, they spun, they were dishonest, they were deceitful, they cast things in a light that was not exactly what it was, but they didn't break the truth. And this guy broke the truth, having every reason to know that 5 seconds after he issued this statement, the truth would come out, which is that Jacobs asked a question and was assaulted in about 4 seconds. So what does this tell us about American public life? Now, you can say, well, it's one seat, 435 congressional seats, some kid in Montana, some idiot candidate in Montana. You know, we don't want to extrapolate too much. But I don't think it's so easy to say that.
I would add also that and the fact is that we're not seeing a whole lot of disputing of Ben Jacobs' side of events because – he was supported by a three-reporter bylined Fox News report detailing and supporting Ben Jacobs' side of events. And without that report, we would have a lot more tribal frustration with Ben Jacobs and rallying around John Forte. But we did see some efforts to sort of project this false machismo from people like Laura Ingraham and others of her ilk who are suggesting that Ben Jacobs should have put up a fight and he didn't, and this is high school, and did they take his lunch money, and oh, he's whining, and what a baby. And this is repulsive. It's just disgusting. That kind of behavior is not acceptable, and no political movement that's even remotely healthy would dare suggest that this is something that they should be embracing and endorsing and defending.
Yeah, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Say it was a Democratic candidate who, like, you know, threw a Breitbart reporter to the ground, put his hands around a Breitbart reporter's neck and threw him to the ground.
Right, of course. What
would Laura Ingraham say in that circumstance? You know perfectly well what she would have said. And this whole notion of listening as we all could to it, to an assault take place. It's not a major assault. Like, he's not going to go to jail for 10 years, you know.
But he was charged. Well, he's charged.
It's a misdemeanor. I mean, he flipped out. He put his hands around the guy's neck. He might, you know, broke his glasses. He may have hurt him. Jacobs could, you know, file a civil suit against him. Whatever. It's like, it's not like a huge deal. Didn't take out a gun and shoot him or something like that, right? But whole point is that if we can't maintain minimal standards of comportment, you know, we spent our lives in the last 20, 30 years talking about who's a role model. And is a is an athlete a good role model? Celebrities, people take them as role models, and they should have some sense of responsibility, and yet they do. And so look at America without these good role models and all of that. Well, one thing that you can say for the sake of absolute truth is that lawmakers in the United States are supposed to, people who want to be lawmakers are not supposed to break the law in front of the entire country and get away and then act and then be defended for it.
Also, there was sort of this response wasn't just because of this random guy who that most of them probably had never heard of before today, but also because it was a reporter who was assaulted. And because the press is the bad guy, then, and the fact that the media rallied around one of its own, was enough to prompt a sort of just reciprocal response, an unthinking, reflexive response to sort of attack that solidarity.
I would say that the truth is that most people on the right that I could see on social media and everything were responded to this appropriately. But the world of the Trumpian media tried not to. Apparently Fox and Friends did not report on it this morning, for example, and like Brent Bozell, who's the head of the Media Research Center, who's an old acquaintance of mine, said Ben Jacobs is a jerk. Now, Ben Jacobs is a jerk because he reported on a story about how mysteriously the Media Research Center bought a house that was owned by one of its senior executives, in a town in Pennsylvania, and basically, you know, if commentary, it would be like my buying Noah's house when he wanted to move somewhere because Noah was having trouble selling it. And so Bozell has a pre-existing hostility toward Ben Jacobs, and so he goes in public and says, Ben Jacobs deserved it because he's a jerk.
See, I've been sitting here trying to think of if I really think this is sort of Donald Trump's fault in a way. And I've come to the conclusion that with or without Trump, this might have happened. But the difference is that with Trump, there is this support network now in place for when thugs act. And there is then a new protocol about how one might respond to this. And that's there's a support network.
I mean, we all remember how terrified and outraged the right was when the SEIU was dispatching its actual legitimate thugs and performing assaults on people who were protesting the ACA and biting fingers. And we all remember that. Everybody had a rational response to that, and we watched the left rally around its own and debase itself in the process. And to see Republicans just march in that direction, just so sheepishly and without any resistance, is
really depressing.
It's
not Republicans, it's Trumpians. And we have two different categories of people. It may well be that the Republicans and the Trumpians are merging and that the Trumpians are taking over the Republicans. What I mean by Trumpians here, not to be offensive, is people who are, for whom the idea is you defend anything that is done by a person on your side, particularly if it's in proximity to a liberal, is defensible, and you are supposed to defend it because that is the dynamic. Like, even if it's true or not true, they're gonna defend their guys. We defend our guys. It's like when you have parents of a little league team who, you know, don't care whether or not somebody was out at second. It's their son's team, and so if their team should be safe, the kid should be safe. And then you have the parents who are like, "What are you talking about? The umpire said he was out. What's the matter with you? You know he was out. You saw it." No. You know, because it's like the other guys would do the same thing. And this sort of journey beyond sort of like the bounds of civil comportment it's not a new thing. I one can't say that it's, you know, November. I blame Bill Clinton for the sort of introduction of outright mendacity becoming a defensible quality in a politician that you must defend because his enemies are so unspeakable. That was, of course, the truth about Clinton in 98 was that the decision was made that, you know, he was being targeted and tormented by, you know, Christian lunatics and power-hungry, you know, corporatist Republicans. And so whatever it is he may or may not have done pale in comparison to what would happen if these people were allowed to get their way against him. And that wasn't even part – it was more like culture war over party or culture war over truth or something like that. This is a different kind of culture war. This is like a culture war about – you know, so the media are bad. So all you have to know is that there was a confrontation between someone in the media and some Republican politician. Obviously, you side with the Republican politician. Now, I can even appreciate that as a sort of like gut instinct, but not when there's a tape. Also, people aren't supposed to, adults are not supposed to grab other people and throw them to the ground. This is part of the fakey machismo thing that Noah's talking about. You know, whether or not you want to think that we're an overly feminized culture or not, people in contemporary America aren't supposed to assault other people in public, particularly if one of them is a political candidate and the other is a reporter, but not even politically. Like, if you saw it, if you were, when we all saw the footage of the guy pulling the doctor off the plane, right? And that was a relatively defensible thing given the protocols of United Airlines and the security system. You saw it and you were like, my God, you can't do that to another human being. I don't care who you are. And, you know, idiot Gianforte, Mr. Rich Guy Montanan philanthropist with a temper problem, isn't allowed to grab somebody by the throat and throw him to the ground.
But that's the link between Bill Clinton and the moment here, is that you perceive it's not, there wasn't a directive, there wasn't some sort of a mission statement that went out and everybody had to do X. It was just you perceived and you understood that your team demanded of you this moral compromise, and you will willingly compromise preemptively for your team.
And I just want to go back to say that, not to enter into the fever swamps of the 2016 Trump, anti-Trump, anti-anti-Trump thing, but one of the reasons that people were concerned that the, you know, against Trump issue of the National Review was done, that, you know, we wrote things in 2016 about this, was this question of whether Trump's personal behavior and the behavior that he encouraged by saying he was happy that people were beating up protesters, and the behavior that he allowed, you know, that he sort of subsumed when it was okay that Corey Lewandowski had manhandled the reporter Michelle Fields from Breitbart. That being an early example of this, which is that Michelle Fields worked for Breitbart, and Breitbart defended Corey Lewandowski against its own reporter because its tribal interest was with Trump. So that gives you a sense of this. And the idea was that this was something we didn't really need to see in American life, that this was not going to be a good example of where we were civilizationally. And we can't say that this incident, you know, is proof positive of that, but we need to see what the next 2 or 3 years are like. Now, I want to say one thing before we go. We're going to talk about the American Healthcare Act and how, you know, I don't think there's going to be an American Healthcare Act now, but how incredibly, let's say, I was going to say unjust the Congressional Budget Office report is, but unjust is not the right word. That what it says, it predicts out to the future that 50 million people will lose their healthcare in 2026, but that, you know, if things stay the way they are, that it'll remain around where it is now, 14 or 15 or 19 million or something like that, and that this is an insane and unjust way to look at this because it assumes that the status quo of the healthcare system will remain, and in fact the American healthcare system and the Obamacare exchanges are collapsing, and the notion that all those people aren't going to lose their coverage is insane. They are going to lose their coverage, and if you don't game it out with that in mind or try to figure that out as a variable, you are doing a terrible injustice. But so such it is. But I want to move on to a more important topic, because my friend Mark Ancorn, who my former rabbi, who is now a lawyer in San Diego, specifically said we should discuss the question of whether Donald Trump had tried to hold Melania's hand when they were walking down the red carpet, and did she slap it away? And, you know, how would we look at that? And I've looked at it over and over and over again. I've seen the Zapruder film analysis that says he was reaching and then she was reaching and then he was and she was slapping. He was slapping and she was slapping. She wasn't slapping really because he reached and then she read. Then he slapped. She slapped. It is my considered opinion that she slapped his hand away. I've watched it 15 times, and I just can't get away from the idea that he reached for her hand and they said, and she slapped his hand away.
Okay, I'm of the opposite opinion. I think that there was a timing issue that made it appear as if she was slapping his hand away when it was really a sort of last dash for his hand that was then sort of the window was closing on the amount of time that she had to grab it. But I think this because similar tapes and similar footage of Melania and Trump, it's sort of it takes two different approaches. Like on the one hand, there's the she's fed up with him stuff footage, and then there's also the stuff of her sort of cowering in fear, possibly, you know. Yeah. when he'll shoot her nasty look. So you can sort of paint any picture that you want with this stuff.
Having not performed the requisite forensic analysis of this tape, I can't say whether or not there was hand slapping, but I will say that there were images of the two of them lovingly holding hands in the Sistine Chapel. So there is counter.
And where better, really, to have a nice intimate moment where you hold hands than in the Sistine Chapel?
I will add.
People make out there all the time. You know, it's like it's kind of
there's
like
nowhere to hide. It's a very small room.
Yeah, well, it's not. The Sistine Chapel is
small. It's smaller than you think it would be.
I've been there. It's
so
not small. I wouldn't call it small.
Well, it's smaller than your average grand cathedral, let's say.
It's not that small. There are corners. They got like 3 or 4 different, you know, areas. Anyway.
Okay, I will add, however, that I do believe that Melania is a very unhappy person and doesn't want this to be the Trump presidency. Wants to go home to Manhattan.
I don't know. One reads, you know, you don't know what goes on in somebody else's marriage and all of that, and I have no idea, but we know nothing about her. I think we will never know anything about her. I will say that I think it's pretty clear that he needs her to be living, her and Barron to be living in the White House, because at least he'll have somebody there at night to distract him from spending 4 hours getting into a towering rage watching his TiVo over and over again.
What you mean is we need her and Barron.
We need her. That's right. That's right. She is an immigrant to this country. Yes. And she came here. She made a success of herself. She married a very important, and her, what she needs to do for this country is go live in that White House and distract him.
Yes.
Distract him at night so that he gets off the Twitter and he stops watching the TiVo. This has been a wonderful week in many ways because he's been out of the country and there's been nothing on Twitter. And he actually issued a pretty good statement today about wanting to get to the bottom of how this terrible leak happened, where we were an American, some American leaked the name of the Manchester bomber. And it's a good, it's a well thought through statement, and maybe the first one of his presidency, and maybe heralds a, you know, a new future. But speaking of hands, of course, if you haven't seen it, go to YouTube or somewhere and find the thing that happened this morning, which was Donald Trump shaking the hand of the new French president, Emmanuel Macron. If you want to see, you know, it's really like he had, Trump has a joy buzzer in his hand and it's not going off, and he needs to keep that handshake and press it so that finally that he'll get the joy buzzer thing. I get this analogy because I bought my son a joy buzzer and we, and it just wasn't working, and we were like squeezing our hands together and he wasn't letting me go, and then finally it worked a little bit. So maybe Trump had a joy buzzer in his hand. You wouldn't put it past him. It's funny, you know.
He's got something, I think, sort of OCD about handshakes generally.
No, but he used to not touch. I mean, when I first met him in the mid '90s, he would not touch and say He was a germaphobe. He would not touch anybody's hand. Like, that was, you went to meet, he wouldn't shake your hand. And then, in fact, it was an editorial board meeting of the New York Post, and somebody said, like, "Mr. Trump, you know, I notice, you know, I know you don't like to shake anybody's hand." He said, "Well, why would anybody want to shake anybody else's hand? There are germs. It's dirty. I mean, it just seems like a, you know, it's a sensible thing to do. Like, you know, I mean, I'm perfectly friendly. I don't need to, you know, shake your hand to be friendly." So in that sense, I think he was a real trailblazer for the Purell generation. And of course, the Obamas didn't really shake people's hands either. You know, they were fist bumpers. And that, again, is a doctor thing. Like, the doctors are telling people not to shake hands, and to, particularly if you're like a politician, because if you're on the campaign trail, you'll get horribly sick. You know, if you shake 5,000 hands, someone's going to have some, you know, virulent germ on his hands and, like, knock you 6 ways from Sunday. So I say she swatted his hand away. Abe says no. Noah is chicken and won't come up with an opinion, but says Melania is unhappy. And I say we need her in the White House, doing her patriotic duty as an American to distract the president, and that Trump had a joy buzzer in his hand when he shook Macron's hand. I don't really believe that. I just want to stipulate that because people are very literalist sometimes. Right?
Sure.
Okay. So iTunes, go to iTunes. This was such a thrilling close to this podcast. It's such a high level discussion that you should go to iTunes and at least say that we can be light spirited and funny if you think we are. It'll really help if you do. Tell your friends to listen. Go to commentarymagazine.com, get a few free reads, and subscribe. And we'll talk to you next week. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.